My book covers the period of time that I spent in Kosovo and Albania during the Kosovo conflict of that period in 99. So it covers a period of 8 weeks. Rather than going through aspects of the book now, what I'll do, I'll go through what I experienced in that conflict in the time whilst I was involved in the conflict, and we'll open up to questions later to discuss issues pertaining to that and what happened before and afterwards. So I won't spend too much time on the history of the Balkans because we could be here for 6 or 7 hours or days. So my background is that I'm a trauma surgeon. I've had an interest in trauma surgery. I first worked in as a junior surgeon in Israel and Gaza during the first Intifada, where I was part of a medevac team. I then went to Kosovo, and since then I've been to East Timor with our special forces and Afghanistan similarly in 2008 in support of Australian special forces and NATO forces. The Kosovo conflict. A brief history. Yugoslavia, as it existed in 1945 up until 1991, was an amalgamation of these states: Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia, Serbia, Macedonia and Montenegro. And things went on fairly well, to make it simplified a little. Racially, basically all of Yugoslavia, apart from Kosovo at that point in time, was pretty well ethnically Slav. They were Slavic. My background is my mother is from Slovenia. Kosovo, on the other hand, was predominantly ethnic Albanian, 90% ethnic Albanian, and about 10% Serb, because of the migration across into Kosovo after the battle described by Oliver. We had the initial Balkan Wars, and I won't go through those now, but the war in Croatia from 91 to 93, and the one in Bosnia from 92 to 95, from which have many horrific memories, and from in which we saw the first major ethnic cleansing and genocide since the Second World War. When I arrived, I arrived in early 1999. The Kosovo War is very complex, but in a nutshell, President Milosevic wanted to maintain control of Kosovo as it was very important to the Serbs ethnically, religiously and historically. As it was predominantly ethnic Albanian, they pretty much wanted to take Kosovo back for a greater Serbia. That's it in a nutshell. It is much more complex than that, but I won't dwell on the politics now. We can discuss that later. So I turned up into this situation. I watched on television as we saw hordes of refugees fleeing from Kosovo into Albania and neighbouring countries in a mass exodus, which reminded me of what was happening during the Second World War. My grandfather was spent 2.5 years in the Dachau and Mauthausen concentration camps as he was captured as a Yugoslav partisan. And with my background in trauma surgery and combined with a call from the United Nations and the world community for surgeons who could work in combat zones, I, with only a little bit of thought and a lot of impulse, put my hand up. And it was an interesting decision. It was a difficult time in my life in that I was just remarried and I had a 5-year-old son. I was only married 4 months, so anyone who's recently married in here, I wouldn't recommend it. So I arrived to this. As I arrived, the total number of refugees or internally displaced people within Kosovo was approximately 1.45 million, which is about 90% of the ethnic Albanian population. The majority were in Albania, northeastern Albania, several in Macedonia and Montenegro, but the majority of the influx was across into Albania, and this is where I volunteered. I worked in a town called Kukës, which some people in the audience here have had first-hand experience of, in which there were several refugee camps housing up to 130,000 refugees at its peak. I worked with this group here, the International Medical Corps, a group of American medicos, nurses, logisticians who sent surgical teams to hotspots, basically, to treat patients and to teach locals. The other groups involved under the umbrella of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees was the Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, the International Red Cross, World Food Programme, Oxfam, and these two, as I call unsung heroes, the United Arab Emirates, who sent a huge team of military personnel and who set up a camp for nearly 45,000 refugees, all funded by one very wealthy sheikh who was a colonel in the army, out of the kindness of his heart, and the Italians, who set up the Italian Military Red Cross Hospital, which housed nearly 30,000 refugees. And they did a fantastic job. My role was, soon after I arrived there, I was seen as an independent surgeon who had skills, and I was nominated as the surgical coordinator for all of Northern Albania, responsible for these groups in the camps, regional hospitals, and the mobile surgical units. As I didn't belong to one of the larger groups, I was nominated as the most independent person to help coordinate surgical services for all the refugees and to liaise with the local Albanian health officials, who we'll discuss shortly. When I arrived in Tirana, this is what greeted me in the Tirana airport, the capital of Albania. At that point in time, Albania was a very poor country, and I'll describe that a little further, but it was very heavily militarised by the NATO. NATO was paying the Albanian government large amounts of money to use their airspace and to basically coordinate operations against Serbian forces in Kosovo. So this is an important point to bear in mind later in the talk. But NATO was paying the Albanian government large amounts of money to allow the war to proceed. Albania was fairly much lawless at that point in time. There was no real functioning government. Organised crime was the modus operandi in most areas. Transport between large cities, particularly between Tirana and the northeast, was very hazardous because of bandits who would rob, murder and steal. Because the country was so poor and impoverished, most people resorted to crime, and because there was no government or real infrastructure, it was quite terrifying and very unpredictable. So we had to fly by chopper to the town of Kukës. This is the town of Kukës, which housed normally about 20,000 people at the most. This is the Pashtrik mountain range, the other side of which is Kosovo. And it's quite beautiful at a distance. It's probably prettier now, but again, Albania was a very, very poor country. And this slide I've put up previously, and several people in the audience would have seen this before, but this pretty well summed up Albania of 1999. There was very little infrastructure, one of the few decent roads in Kukës. Livestock wandering freely, fairly poorly fed and managed. Most people were subsistence farmers. The average income was less than $3 a month. And that stems from the previous president, President Hoxha, who kept the country so isolated and paranoid that it would be invaded by the West, that he could basically run the country as a fiefdom, much like we see in North Korea now. And the population was kept petrified that they would be invaded. So President Hoxha built 750,000 of these bunkers throughout the country with the country's limited resources, and pretty well what was left of the gross domestic product went into his pockets. So the people were pretty well starving, uneducated, just in a terrible way. The Albanians suffered a lot over 45 years. And this is not being derogatory to the Albanians. This was the state of the country at that point in time, as literally a third world country within Europe with a very impoverished population. Now, you mentioned the refugees. This is the border crossing between Albania and Kosovo, or at that stage, Serbia, the province of Kosovo. This is the Serbian border patrol station. We had up to 15,000 refugees crossing the border daily, mainly on foot, some in their tractors, because many were in the region were farmers and brought everything they could with them in their tractors. Many walked for many days. They were harassed along the way by Serbian regular forces and paramilitary forces. Many were killed on the way, many were injured. In this photo here, there's a little clearing where one of the Serb border units had a mortar position. And just for fun, at least twice while we were there, they would set their mortars, most people know what mortars are, they're an explosive device where you drop a shell down. They would set them at nearly 90 degrees, so they would hit the refugee column just on the other side within Kosovo, just to terrorise refugees. And a lot of the actions of the paramilitaries, the Serb paramilitaries, was to terrify people and horrify them so that they would never come back, and it was pretty effective. One of the other sad things we saw at the border was that a lot of the women were on the run for several weeks. Many had given birth on the run, and to prevent their infants from being heard by Serb patrols whilst they were running away, they would cover them up in blankets, and many of the infants and newborn babies had actually suffocated. And when they unwrapped the babies at the border, they were dead. And we saw that at least on 12 occasions. So they're pretty awful scenes. When the refugees came from the Merida border crossing, we checked them in our surgical unit and they would be sent back to Kukus in the transit camp, where we try and divide them into family groups, regional groups, or groups where they at least had some connection, because the families are often broken up as they're fleeing the Serb forces. The camps, sorry if I'm going quickly, I'll go through it very quickly so we have time to discuss things later, because it's difficult to cover a war in 30 minutes, but we'll try and do it. This is an example of the camps. It doesn't look like much, but this is the camp built by Colonel Mahmoudi, who was also a sheikh. The United Arab Emirates have these tents, which are actually double insulated. They had ventilation, and they had sanitized water, food, and even entertainment for the kids. Here they were building an outdoor cinema to show films to the children. And they even had a sanitarium for TB patients. So they did wonderful work. This photo shows the Action Against Hunger supplying food to the UAE camp. And that's a photo, the back of a photo of the sheikh as he's just touring his camp, which he, as I said, provided from his own pockets and the pockets of the UAE government, which was basically his. So they did wonderful work. We also had one of the problems in the camps was orphans. And as we mentioned, people fled Kosovo, usually in a big hurry, usually separated from family members. Often family members are killed. So often we had a lot of issues dealing with orphans. This is a photograph of myself with some happy kids giving the victory sign, which was basically the sign the Kosovo Albanians used for an imminent victory in the war. Often the kids were malnourished, very traumatised. We often had to have their heads shaved because they had scabies or head lice. But a lot of the, despite the almost abject poverty in Albania, a lot of the Albanian families took in a lot of these orphans and housed them in their homes. Others were housed in the camps. As I mentioned, they saw many horrific things. Many, as I said, had seen members of their own family killed or other village or town members killed. They'd come across corpses along the way. They were harassed by Serb forces, usually paramilitary forces, right up until they crossed the border. And one of the Italian psychology teams with the Italian Red Cross Hospital would go around the camps and use art therapy to try and get these kids to express what they've seen as a way as a first step in helping them control their anxiety and as a first step to recovery. It's a very early step, but it did help a lot. And we saw many, many pictures and paintings like this, a child with a mother and a dead father. Often there are pictures of the children seeing their parents killed. It was pretty awful, but it did help in the short term. Now, I mentioned I was surgical coordinator for the camps and the hospitals. This is the regional hospital. This is the Kukus Hospital, a 120-bed hospital, if you want to call it that. A lot of rubbish and debris here. Some heavy machine guns mounted on the roof by the hospital director. You may ask why, and as I've said before, we could often do with that occasion on a Saturday night outside the Royal Adelaide Hospital. But it's not politically correct, but it would scare some people away. And so despite the international community and our group and the UNHCR supplying millions of dollars of surgical equipment, disposable equipment to perform operations in the camps and the hospital, when I started operating here, that's me there, this is all we had, a wooden Mayo stand, an operating table, rags for drapes, and this is pretty well the extent of the surgical equipment. Most of this was old and rusty, and if any kids are here, we probably should turn away for this little bit, but this is me taking off a leg with one of the Albanian surgeons, Ilbert Vata. We had gauze swabs that were boiled and hung up to dry and reused from patient to patient. Where this man was struck by a landmine and he needed to have his leg off. Actually, I didn't show that, so I thought there was an amputation there, but you don't have to worry about that. And basically, the patients we had limited resources. We didn't even have drains for abdominal wounds. This is a glove we had to use as an abdominal wound. An IV, intravenous line, we had to use as a tube to put in the stomach, and many of these patients died. And it was pretty infuriating, considering the resources we were putting in. On the other hand, we had other services, such as our mobile surgical unit, which we took to the border. Now, that lasted 1 week before it was ransacked by local organised criminals and was useless. We had the Italian Red Cross military hospital with two surgical units and the commander, as I mentioned, a well-fed Colonel Toccafundi, who was a vascular and trauma surgeon. He did fantastic work and, as I've said many times before, he's one of the unsung heroes. That was an excellent surgical unit. The UAE actually built a 1 kilometre long runway, flew in an inflatable surgical hospital and had it up and running within about 6 days. So we had those services and we had the Kukes Hospital. And you saw the Kukes Hospital. Despite this, we were instructed to take all the patients from the border straight to the Kukes Hospital so they could get the world's best standard of care. This is the direction of the local hospital director and the health department in Kukes, which was pretty baffling. And the reason for it was basically they were extorting the patients. Refugees who turned up injured to the Kukes Hospital had to pay 200 Deutschmarks. If they didn't have money, they were either sent away, they were manhandled, in a few cases, they were kicked out and left to die behind the hospital, and there are reports that some were even being murdered. And this was happening over and over again, and it was pretty obvious from the word go that this wasn't going to change. This is a man who had been crossing the border and had been shot in the chest many days earlier. He died. An older man who'd been injured by a landmine, had infection, who came to the hospital to be treated. He was refused treatment. A young man who'd been shot through the arms and who had blood poisoning from the infection that ensued was refused treatment, and he later died. So as you can see, as an Australian surgeon going across there, giving up my time and almost risking my marriage and my life to help, it was pretty infuriating seeing the poor Kosovo Albanian refugees being treated like this by the local hospital. And the hospital director was in fact, if not one of the local organised criminal heads, he was in partnership with them, and the hospital was his business. And so in order to change this, I thought we'd bring it to the attention of the United Nations. So we picked a typical case, a young girl, Bessiana, who was about 25. She was pregnant at the time her village was attacked by a Serb paramilitary group, and they killed one of her children and her husband. She fled into the hills with her mother. She gave birth in the as she was on the run. Just before she crossed the border into Albania, she was involved in a crossfire between Serbian and Kosovo Liberation Army forces, and she was shot in the leg. She was taken to the Kukes Hospital and denied treatment. We snuck her out at night, and Colonel Toccafundi and I, we operated on her in the Italian hospital. So I explained this story to this man, who a few people here may recognise. It was Kofi Annan, who was the former Secretary General of the United Nations, who turned up for a tour, and we knew he was coming. So we presented this case to him. We explained the story much as I have then. He looked at me and looked at Bessiana and looked at the Italian doctor who was with me and said, it's a terrible tragedy, and then just moved on. And that was the extent of the UN, United Nations involvement or will to be involved in that sort of corruption. They knew it was happening. They didn't want to rock the boat because they were guests of the Albanian government. If they rocked the boat, they may have been asked to leave. So he was in a difficult position, but it put a lot of us in an even more difficult position. And in the background there's some interpreters, a few compatriots of the hospital director who didn't take very favourably to me describing their story. So being stubborn, probably being an Aussie and male and a bit younger then, I wasn't putting up with that because we had to do something. So I had a friend who was working with this newspaper, which is the United States military newspaper, which is printed throughout the world, and is reviewed every week by the NATO Secretary General, who at that time was General Wesley Clark. So I took this reporter through the hospital. He saw exactly what was happening because the corruption was so blatant they didn't even try and hide it. Took photos, wrote up a story which made it to the front page of the Stars and Stripes. Within 24 hours we had NATO on the blower to the Albanian Health Ministry, and we were told that we were allowed to use the surgical hospitals in the camps. So I thought that was fantastic. We could now treat the refugees who were injured as they came across the border. But unfortunately, just at that point in time, Serb forces shut the border between Kosovo and Albania. So all this work and all this troublemaking was in vain. The result of this was that understandably, I wasn't very popular with the local Albanian health officials or the organised criminals. I was stuck. I couldn't help anyone there. So to cut a long story short, I decided to move closer to the front line with the Kosovo Liberation Army to help treat injured Kosovo Liberation Army fighters and refugees fleeing across the borders, which were now closed. This is just a joke slide taken by one of our Canadian doctors of us stealing back the equipment we donated to the hospital, which would have ended up in on the black market and padding the hospital director's pockets. So we moved to a base close to the front line. This is the border between Kosovo and Albania. This is the front line, Mount Prastrik. Moved from Kukës to a base at Helshan. This all looked very nice. It was a Kosovo Liberation Army base run by a nice military commander. They had a wonderful surgical unit with shiny new surgical equipment. Not as good as in the UAE or the Italian hospitals, but still fantastic and better than we had in Kukës. Anesthetic machines, sterilizers, oxygen concentrators, sutures, clamps, everything. But it looked very shiny and clean. And the reason for that was that it was so far from the front line that no one survived to make it to this camp. But the Kosovo Liberation Army commander was very proud to have his surgical unit and now to have a surgeon there. But he wasn't very keen to let me move closer to the front. But I eventually did. And I moved closer with this group here, who do look like a fierce fighting force. Some of them have military training and were well trained, but the majority were volunteer Kosovars from either Kosovo, or a large number were Kosovar expatriates from Germany, the US, England, who have come from all walks of life to volunteer to fight. This group was the Atlantic Battalion, who are from the US, predominantly from Boston, New York, and Chicago. And this is an example of who was I was fighting with. These are young men and women. This young girl here was 17 at the time. I eventually helped train them in how to camouflage, how not to get shot, and how to survive at the front line as a method of preventing them being killed and preventing me from being killed by Serb forces or by them. A lot of the young girls thought this would be a good idea, the American girls, to wear a bright bandana, which, as for anyone here with any military training or even without military training and mainly common sense, would think that was an easy target for a sniper. She turned out to be a very good fighter and is actually one of the presidential bodyguards in Kosovo at the moment. So her training has improved and she's done very well. Unfortunately, this man died after the war, and as did this young fellow. This is a photo of a friend of mine now who runs a pizza bar in Boston and in Brooklyn. And this, I put this photo here to show this weapon. This was a 50 caliber sniper rifle. It was the state of the art in 1999, delivered by US Special Forces to the base. So the US and NATO were supplying weapons to the Kosovo Liberation Army, and they were letting them go to the front line to do the fighting. The problem was, this is a hard piece of weaponry to use. I do a lot of shooting. I did, in my younger years, shooting goats and roos as a professional colour in the north of South Australia. It takes a long time to get to know how to use one of these, to sight it in and to know what you're doing with it. They just presented these guys with these weapons and expected them to know how to use it. So that was the calibre of the people who were going up to the front line to fight the Serb forces. They had more courage than I could ever imagine. They were very loyal. They would have put their life on the line, but they had very little training. So they were coming up against a pretty ferocious enemy. Closer to the front line was this hospital, which was actually a mosque hall. We came across this on the way to the front, and this is the Norwegian surgical unit, which was run in combination with the Kosovo Liberation Army. The Norwegian government provided money through this Norwegian Aid Council to set up a surgical unit. The Norwegians are very open-minded and don't care too much for politics, and they will do what it takes to help those in need. So we arrived here. We saw these sort of injuries. This man was hit by a landmine. They had X-ray equipment, which we didn't have functioning at Kukës. And this next slide is a bit gory for any kids here. Good, he's on his iPod. And this shows myself taking off a leg with Dr. Foss, a Norwegian cardiothoracic surgeon. And this slide shows we had the proper equipment. We had anaesthetist. We even had disposable gowns. These are disposable paper gowns that even in some hospitals in Australia today we can't afford to use. And this was in the middle of nowhere, right near the front line. But talking to the soldiers and refugees who made it here, they said they were the lucky ones. It was still 6 kilometres from the absolute front line of the fighting, so most of their comrades and the other refugees were dying at the front. So that led me to put my hand up again and move close to the front line to provide services where they're needed and where they could be most effective. So I moved up to the forward jump station. This is about 1 kilometre down the mountain from the front line. This is the base at Sahan. And without being too derogatory to the KLA forces, it was not very well run, but they had a lot of heart. An example was, this is a 50 calibre anti-aircraft and anti-personnel weapon. The Serb forces were there, and there were 3 of these situated around the base pointing in towards the headquarters. So the command and leadership wasn't fantastic at this point in the war. There were certain good commanders and good soldiers, but the organisation was pretty poor and a little bit frightening. The US Special Forces would come up to this base. They would take these Americans and US Humvee. They were meant to be very inconspicuous, but they would come up a little narrow path in a Humvee, not many Humvees in Albania, with a big American flag on the back. And they would take coordinates from the Kosovo Liberation Army forces at the front line to send back to NATO to bomb Serb forces. They wouldn't go all the way to the front line because they weren't allowed to. And these two brothers died after the war in awful circumstances, which we can discuss later. I moved up to the front line. This was pretty much the absolute front line. Mount Prestrick at about 2,000 metres, and at our closest point we were only 300 to 400 metres from Serb patrols that would come up the mountain. This is the front line here. This is where we were situated with about 1,100 KLA fighters and limited equipment against nearly 9,000 Serb forces, regular and paramilitary, who had artillery, tanks, and mortars and surface-to-air missiles. So it was a pretty uneven match. The routine during the day was that we would, at night time, NATO would bomb from a high altitude. High altitude bombing, which wasn't very accurate, and which would stop just before dawn so that they wouldn't be targets of Serbian missiles. Then Serb forces, knowing that they had freedom during the day, would shell us. This is a photo of bombs going off just before NATO bombing run stopped, just before dawn. It's pretty light, but it's just before, it's about 5 in the morning. And most of these bombs were going off all over the place here, whereas Serb forces were down here. So it was a bit of a mystery as to why none of the bombs were hitting anything, and hundreds of bombs were going off in this area. This is a photo of one of the teams I worked with, a retrieval team of 6 of us there, myself. All the other guys are Americans. We had 12 to start with. And this team helped me a lot of the time treating patients in a cave, which I'll show you, or going on patrol behind Serb lines. Often we had to sleep in dugouts here made from limestone rock because of the amount of incoming mortar fire. And you were pretty safe if you were sleeping in one of these, unless something landed right on top of you, and in which case you'd be pretty unlucky. But it kept a lot of us alive, but it was very cold. I'm sorry I'm rushing through this, but I'll do that so we can discuss things later. When I arrived at the mountain, the casualties were being treated by a pharmacist in this shepherd's hut. And there's a stretcher. He was on his own. None of the Albania or Kosovo doctors or commanders would come this close to the front to help out. So we had a pharmacist looking after 1,100 people. Most of the other doctors were sitting down in that special hospital in Krume with the Norwegians and would refuse to come up. One of the huts was hit a few days before, killing several of the people inside. This was in full view of Serb artillery positions. You could see mortar crews down the mountain. So I wasn't going to hang around there for long. So we found a shepherd's cave, which was a bit closer to the front line, a bit closer to the Serb forces, but facing away from Serb forces. And this is where I set up a surgical unit at the front. This was the operating table, a stretcher. We often had to use the mattresses beside it. This is all the surgical equipment I had. This is my weapon. And these sleeping bags we used for body bags for the men and women who didn't survive. This is a photo taken by one of the soldiers of me operating there during a busy time. We saw all sorts of injuries, leg injuries, chest injuries, arm injuries. We had to use branches of wood to hold up the IV fluids or whatever IV fluids we had to give. And the sleeping bags in the back filled up very quickly, and we often had to sleep the night in there with the dead in the back of the cave because it was too dangerous to bury them in daylight hours because of Serb snipers and mortar crews. Now, if you want to lose weight, this is one way to do it. The only way up and down that mountain was by goat track, and it was heavily mined, so you had to carry everything on your back. And mentor who assisted me and myself, we made that trip about 18 times up and down. And I lost a lot of weight. But it was the only way to get up and down from the base camp to the front line to take supplies and to bring down injured civilians. Fatmir, a pizza bar owner from Brooklyn, he had a little more money than most of the people at front, and he paid one of the shepherds for a donkey to carry his equipment. So he was lucky. This shows what happens during the day. Serb mortars would be landing all day. There were Serb mortar crews and snipers firing on us and refugees fleeing across the front pretty well all day, from as soon as NATO stopped bombing till the evening. And these are mortars going off only 50 to 70 metres from the cave entrance. But fortunately, no one in the cave was killed or injured. And this is one of the fellows with a souvenir, a 120mm mortar, which missed him, but he was taking that home for a souvenir. Going back a bit, occasionally when you go off to war zones, you do bring back souvenirs, and I brought back a piece of this rocket because it's a Katyusha rocket, which often fired in groups of 20 or 30. This one didn't go off and just broke into pieces, literally 7 metres from us, so I brought a bit of that home just as a good luck charm. That's when you could get through airports before September 11th, before sniffer dogs. Now, I mentioned what I would also do is not just treat people at the front, but I would go with patrols behind Serb lines, usually at dusk, at night time, or before dawn, to retrieve injured civilians and soldiers from the villages that were along the border. Serbian paramilitary forces would frequently go through there and kill people and try and evict them. I'll go back. And what they would commonly do is, in the front of the front door of the hut, and a lot of these were farming communities, so you'd leave your shoes outside, there'd be shoes outside the hut. They put these fragmentation grenades with a tripwire. So when we walked through to attend to injured people who often left screaming in the houses, our retrieval teams would set off the booby trap and they'd be killed along with the people in the house. And this was in a town near Kuslin, near the front line. And these are photos taken by somebody else later from a massacre that happened at the time that we came across, where many people were killed in their houses, women and children as well, 14 in this particular massacre, and that's been reported to the ICC in The Hague. We'd come back across the front line, and we need a big group to carry stretchers, and you can see you need 6 to 8 people to carry one person across that rocky ground, and we have lots of ankle injuries, and they were very easy targets for snipers and mortar crews. This was one of our last daytime retrievals because we lost too many people doing this. So we ended up having to bring people back from the front line at night. This is, I'll finish shortly, but this is one young man who was hit by a shrapnel from a mortar, which went into the back of his chest. We operated on him in the cave, put a chest tube in with a bit of a glove on the end. We didn't have bottles to drain them. He was very unwell, so decided to take him from the top down to the Norwegian hospital. We had to do that at night time, which had its own dangers in that a lot of the Serb patrols would come up at night time. The landmines are impossible to see at night time, and you moved very slowly. That's just a photo to show one of our teams coming back. That's me looking a lot thinner, only after about 12 days. But we got a lot of people back at night time that way. This is the happy customer afterwards, one of the happy customers. And by the time the war ended, we treated quite a few of these soldiers and refugees. This is back in the Norwegian hospital. The war officially ended on the 10th of June, but bombing and shelling stopped on the in the early hours of the morning of the 9th of June. This is myself with a few of the remaining guys from the retrieval team. This guy is an American, Kosovar. And this is Andy Feeney, who likes to be known. He's an Irish, ex-British commander, ex-Israeli army soldier who volunteered, and there were many volunteers there at that time. We lost, from my original retrieval team, off the 12, we lost 6. By the end of the war, at the front line, we treated more than 300 casualties, either in the cave, over the border, or in the fields, in the areas there. 74 died. Not very good statistics if you're working in a major teaching hospital here in Adelaide, but we managed to save a lot of people by being at the front line, treating them as they came across the front. This is normally where I finish my talk. As far as the book's concerned, the book starts at about this point and goes backwards. But I wouldn't recommend anyone do this. Since I came back from Kosovo, I finished my cardiothoracic surgical training, and then was convinced by friends and by a bit of patriotism and wanting to give something back, I joined the Australian Defence Force and then did more trauma surgery overseas in much better conditions than here. So when I speak to young surgeons wanting to do this sort of work, I tell them they should probably start with a proper army, the Australian Army, do their medical training and then go to somewhere like Timor or Bougainville or Solomon's first, where it's a bit quiet, and then go to more dangerous war zones such as Afghanistan or places like this. But I know it's been a slightly disjointed presentation because I'm speaking to a fairly mixed audience, but I hope it's covered a bit of the Kosovo conflict and my involvement in it. And I think at that point I'll open the floor up for questions, or if Oliver would like to do that. Thank you.
High-level bombers to effectively bomb that area. How on earth did you do that with maps? Did you have a specific skilled compass?
What the gentleman's referring to is that towards the end of the war, which I didn't mention there but is in the book, after being sick of seeing all the death and the shelling from the Serb forces hitting us and the refugees and the NATO bombing being completely ineffectual and seeing how clearly visible the Serb positions were, I thought I would try and prevent it. I'd had training in Israel before and I could read maps and use compasses, and we had a map that the Special Forces gave us, so I decided one day enough was enough, so I took the compass and protractor and we took a small patrol and marked out all the Serb positions on the side of the mountain. I mean, you could do a 2-minute cartography course and you could have mapped these coordinates. We put them on the map and I wrote them on a piece of paper and they were taken back to the Special Forces, who then directed a bombing run which pretty much ended, it didn't end the war, but it stopped the shelling pretty well instantly at that point in time. So ethically you could say, well, should a doctor be doing that? And at that point in time I was a combatant as well. And I was looking after myself, the people around me, and the refugees fleeing across the border. And it was a difficult decision, but one which back then I made very happily. To see if I could see an end to the shelling and I could contribute, I was more than happy to do it. And because the means to doing it was so easy, it was so obvious, and people had been dying for weeks and months before for no good reason, I thought I should do it.
Yes, I was from Australian Army. For that, I was with the British Gurkhas. And I find that a lot of Australians go over there, and it's like before joining Australian Army, they tried to take their own values with having double loyalty, one to Australia and one to their own root.
Yes.
In that sense, what are you trying to prove yourself, a freedom fighter or a terrorist?
Well, it's a good question, and a bit of background to that, the Kosovo Liberation Army, at that point in time, before NATO started bombing, were actually classified as a terrorist group by Serbia and also by various other international organisations. When Milosevic invaded and started ethnically cleansing Kosovo, the Kosovo Liberation Army then came off the terrorist list and were being supported. So that's the bit of background. Now, when you talk about my roots, my mother is Slovenian, not Serbian. My father's Australian. My parents separated very early. I was originally McLaughlin. So I was born here. And so if I was actually going back for my own roots, I should really be on the side. If I was going back for patriotism to a Slavic nation, I should really be going back on the side of the Serbs. I went back to help the victims of the war as I saw it where I was then, and the rest of the world saw it. Before this and since then, I'd worked in other zones helping victims of war in East Timor and Afghanistan. I'm not a Muslim. I'm a very loose Christian, not much of that. So I went there to help the victims of the war. Initially, when I went to Albania, I never intended on going to the front line. The reasons I ended up at the front line were because of the corruption and the fact that I couldn't help people in the village, the town and the camps because of the corruption and because my life was put on the line So I used my skills at the front line where they were most useful. And the people who were being killed and slaughtered in front of my eyes at that point in time were the ethnic Albanians. If there were Serbian civilians or any civilians being killed in front of me, I would help them. I don't really care where they come from, what the history is. The person killing the unarmed civilian is the aggressor. The unarmed civilian being butchered or ethnically cleansed is the victim. So I'm Australian, and I think it's a pretty good Australian principle that we usually help those who are the victims.
Well, perhaps I could ask a question,
yes.
Craig. You referred to the poor quality of the NATO bombing. Is there a lesson there for what's happening in Libya today?
Well, I think with any war, it's pretty obvious you can't win a war or control ground forces by bombing them from 10 kilometres up. And by doing that, by bombing from 10 kilometres up, you're more likely to hit the wrong target, civilians, obviously. And the civilians were killed in Albania and Kosovo. Kosovo, ethnic Albanian civilians fleeing across the border were killed by NATO forces, mistakenly. So, and now if you go forward to Libya now with the developments in technology, laser guidance, satellites, they're still missing targets and unfortunately still hitting civilians. So I think if you're going to put an end to a regime like Colonel Gaddafi's regime, you either do it diplomatically, which didn't work, or if you're going to use force, you should use force appropriately and properly to stop civilians suffering quickly. This war in Libya now has gone on for, 2 months? And it's a full-blown civil war now, so it hasn't worked that well. I mean, if I was planning it, I probably wouldn't have planned it like this. But so there are very direct comparisons between the two. The politics behind the two is very different. The Balkans and Libya are two completely different issues.
Got a couple of questions.
How
do you possibly cope with the consequences of what you've done? I mean, the extreme things that you've seen, because I imagine that you know, your background, I don't know if it prepared you for it, but it seems very extreme. And the second thing, which is perhaps, I hope, a more easy question, what was the most precious moment that came out of your experience?
As to answer the first question, it was tough. I mean, I was more fortunate than most who were, particularly at the front line, and saw what I saw at the front line, in that I had my 34th birthday out there, so I wasn't that young. I mean, that is young, but it seems young now. But and I'd trained as a surgeon, a young surgeon. I'd also was involved in medevac retrievals in Gaza during the Intifada, so I had seen a lot of conflict, nothing like this though, so I was better prepared in that I had training, I was older, I was a medical person used to seeing gore, so the gore side of things didn't bother me that much at all. But it still is stressful, and I did have issues on returning home many years later, which were initially not that well managed, but were managed well now. Now the last second part of the question, a particular moment, a good or bad moment? That's the a precious moment. That's tricky. There weren't many happy moments. There are a few funny moments. A precious but very sad moment was when we'd done a patrol and had come across a village that had been attacked by Serb forces, and there was a family that had been killed, apart from the mother who was left with her son in her arms. And I had to euthanize the woman because Serb forces were coming. She would have been tortured again. That was very distressing, but the most precious and disturbing moment was having to bury her son, which she asked us to do, and bury him away from his home in an unmarked grave. That was precious in a negative way. There were many precious positive moments.
Craig, obviously, your time you spend in the Balkans, I gather you still follow up the what happens there, especially on the political side. Now, I've got a question which is probably a bit connected to the things. As a medical doctor, You came across many allegations about organ transportation and organ the trade in the that happened apparently in Albania, according to a European Parliament member. And now he is in trouble a bit because he can't actually provide proofs on that. The question is the geographical circumstances of that area and the difficulties of getting from a particular point where he where that MP actually puts that the so-called yellow house to go to a town or a city where he can basically go to a civilization, so to say. As far as I know, it's pretty big distance in that time, maybe with more than 10 hours drive. Is it possible for an organ to be transported in that way as a medical doctor? Is it possible to get an organ and keep it somewhere safe and actually have it transported for tens of hours and maybe just get it out of the country, out of Albania, after 2 days or something? Does that work?
Thanks. Yes, so the question is based on allegations that were made that the Kosovo Liberation Army were capturing Serb soldiers and imprisoning them and harvesting their organs, taking them and selling them on the black market. I only learnt of this after I put the book out, and I thought it was a joke initially, because realistically, it was hard enough to keeping injured people alive on that mountain for more than a few hours. To somehow harvest organs, harvest organs, you have to put them in a special insulated, cooled device. You have to transport them quickly to where they're going to be implanted in the person. And it's hard enough doing it here in the Western world. You've seen shows on TV about heart transplants and kidney transplants. So allegations saying that it was happening there completely baffled me. I mean, if it was happening, I didn't see it, and I can't imagine how it could happen. So some of these allegations come up as a counter to people, for example, like myself, exposing what happened and the atrocities committed by the Serb side. I should counter that in that at the end of the war, as in at the end of every war, there are no two sides to the war. And as the Kosovars moved back into Kosovo at the end of the war, there were lots of retribution killings of Serb civilians, of Roma or Gypsies who helped the Serbs evict the ethnic Albanians. And a lot of the people who were killed were actually innocent. So that's one of the unfortunate but almost unavoidable consequences of a war, is that there will be retribution killings. And they're completely unjustified, and they should be investigated as well. But it's a messy war. It's not black and white. It wasn't black and white. And let's hope it doesn't happen again.
This is a much more practical question. When you must have been suffering frustration and angst when you had limited or negligible supplies. Where did your supplies come from? And when you had IV fluids at times, where did all that come from?
Well, either myself or other patrols would have to run from the front down to Sahan and down to the Norwegian base camp. That took about 6 to 8 hours, and then run back and come back up again. And contend with landmines, Serb patrols. So often we ran out of IV fluids very quickly. And towards the end of the war, I was using bits of packing tape that the surgical packs came in, tape to tie off vessels. And we basically ran out of almost all equipment. So soldiers who I picked up or I saw injured, if I didn't clamp their vessels quickly or put tourniquets on their legs, they would die. So it was pretty very, very basic towards the end. So it was very frustrating. I mean, you just resign yourself to the fact that you can only do what you can do with what you have at hand.
Craig,
yes.
Doubtless you're following what some of the follow-ups from the war in Kosovo and the current trials which are taking place in The Hague.
Yes.
Do you have any knowledge regarding the crimes or alleged crimes committed, which are now being tried in The Hague, and is there any chance of you being called to give evidence?
Well, the most recent the headline trials is the capture of Mladic and Karadzic. That pertained to the Bosnian War, which I had nothing to do with. A lot of the paramilitaries that were involved in the Bosnian War were actually fighting in the Kosovo War, and there have been quite a few convictions of Serbian commanders from the paramilitary troops, and also a few convictions of Kosovo Albanians in The Hague. I'm not sure how many, but people ask me, do you think justice will be done? I mean, when you look at a war like this, you have, for example, the war in Bosnia, you have Milosevic, who died. Now you have President Karadzic and General Mladic in The Hague. They're two people. Two people didn't kill 110,000 civilians. The people who are putting the guns to the head and shooting and shelling and bombing the people all walked back to their normal lives and now are in normal jobs in politics. So justice can't really be done, but it's a start.
One final question. Is there anyone?
Do you have any understanding of the atrocities that are caused during wars or how people get to that level? You talked about retribution killings and those gruesome deaths that are bestowed on people during war times.
Well, it's an interesting topic. The question is, why do people commit mass murder or ethnic cleansing? How can people who are living together one year then turn on their neighbours and start killing them? A lot of it is, particularly in the Bosnian War and the Kosovo War, by way of dehumanising the people you're going to kill. So it's basically the whole system. For example, during the Milosevic era, they would instill in the minds of the young people that, for example, the Bosnian Muslims or the Kosovo Albanians were subhuman. They weren't quite human. So by dehumanising your victims, it's a lot easier to commit awful crimes. That's one aspect. In the Kosovo War particularly, alcohol and drugs were a big feature in the Serbian military and paramilitary forces. So they had a lot of alcohol, a lot of speed and drugs on top of that to complicate things. As far as the atrocities committed at the end of the war, most of that was revenge and retribution, which is as old as history of humankind. You can never justify atrocities or ethnic cleansing or genocide. You can always explain them, but they can never be justified.
I think that's actually a very important thing that Craig has just said, and it's a very good point on which to close this discussion, allowed a little bit of extra time because the topic is so serious and so important. I would like to thank Craig very much for his extraordinarily thoughtful presentation of a truly ghastly story out of which there are no winners, no losers. Well, there are a lot of losers there, but there are no winners from what's happened. And it's very good of Craig to give us his time to take us through what happened as he saw it. I would urge you all to read the book. It's not an enjoyable book to read, but it's a very significant statement, and I think anyone who reads it will get a lot out of it. So thank you again, Craig.
Thanks, all. Thank you very much.